5 minutes, yeah.
5 minutes, certainly.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Brandy Klass, and I represent Mr. Bell, the appellant in this matter. The trial in this case is a divorce matter, was had over the course of 2 days in the Richmond Circuit Court. Two biggest assets involved in the divorce were a business that husband started before the parties married and a home that husband owned before the parties married. At the conclusion of the wife's evidence, husband's counsel moved to strike as far as the business and the house. She argued that wife didn't present the evidence to value those assets or to have them determined to be classified as marital in any way or to be distributed. The trial court found that she agreed that the wife didn't meet her burden by the civil standard. However, she still let...
Isn't that mooted by the fact that under the existing precedent, which your opposing counsel cites, once you present your own case, which you did, you had some evidence, that essentially wipes out the first motion to strike. And then what we're left with is the totality of the evidence, and you have to renew your motion, and that's what counts.
And she did, Your Honor. And at the very end of the case, after husband presents his evidence, trial counsel for husband does renew the motion to strike.
So does the first motion to strike even have any legal significance? All we look at is the second one.
It does, Your Honor. It's the court's finding that she hadn't met her burden. The court found at one point in the
trial... But isn't that essentially the court... The way I think you could fairly read that statement is the court essentially saying, well, accepting this burden that... Or the way we have to look at the evidence in the context of a motion to strike, which is in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. So you look at it through that particular lens at that juncture. Isn't that essentially what the court is saying?
Well, Judge, it's not only looking at it in the light most favorable to the wife, but it's did they make an error of law? Did the court not only view the evidence? I'm not saying just that the court should have viewed the evidence differently and shouldn't have thought that wife met a burden. The court actually made an error of law. If she didn't think wife had met her burden, then the motion to strike should have been granted. And there was nothing else husband could do at that junction. He couldn't stop the case and appeal it then. He had to wait until the end of the trial, and he did renew his motion to strike.
The court didn't make that comment at the second motion to strike.
The court didn't do anything other than take the motion under advisement. And wife argues on appeal, one of the arguments is that husband didn't preserve the issue about the motion to strike because he didn't object to it at the end of the trial. But he couldn't have objected to it at the end of the trial. He makes the motion.
When all of this comes, I mean, it seems like an artificial point because at the end of the case, you made a detailed motion to reconsider, making all of these arguments, and the court actually ruled on it. So why isn't that the point at which we look at the court's ruling as opposed to the taking under advisement or the first motion that's wiped out?
Which is, I think you can look at it either way. I mean, if you rule on the motion to strike, though, then there are a lot of other arguments you don't have to consider that wife has brought up on her appeal. It's just the ruling on the motion to strike. Judge, and one of the issues that wife's raised on appeal is that issue wasn't preserved. If you look at the very end of the trial, husband makes the motion to strike. The court asks any rebuttal. Wife's counsel says no. The court says, all right, the court's going to take the matter under advisement. So there was no ruling on the motion to strike. So husband could not have objected to the court's, one, not ever ruling on it.
Does he have an obligation to get one before he comes here?
Well, he asked, Your Honor. He asked in his motion to reconsider. He had no idea that the court wasn't going to rule on it or that the court wasn't going to grant it until he actually received the entered final decree. Because the court didn't do a letter opinion. The court just issued a final decree saying this is its finding. And he then, within the time limit, filed a motion to reconsider and asked the trial court to rule on it. And then asked the trial court to also grant it, but at least rule on it. And the court never did that. I mean, and a litigant can't make the court not take the matter under advisement. I mean, if you make a motion to strike and the judge says, I'm going to take it under advisement, there's nothing he can do with that matter other than, you know, at that junction, other than wait for the ruling.
Let me ask, I'm switching gears on you, but let me ask you about the corroboration point. You need corroboration, but if there's no evidence of collusion, which there isn't, and the corroboration needs to be only slight, then why can't that slight corroboration be established through documentary evidence as opposed to live testimony or whatever?
Judge, I think it could be. The reason that the corroboration was important in this case is because of the party's understanding that the case wasn't over yet. And the reason for making that objection on appeal was in case there was another issue that the court found or that wife argued was not preserved. It's customary in a divorce matter to have your trial and then submit your depositions, your no-fault depositions, after the trial. And so it goes to the understanding of husband that the case wasn't over yet. He was waiting for an opinion letter. He was still waiting for the counsel was waiting to submit the no-fault depositions, but instead they get an opinion letter, the case is decided, and they then have to make their objections. So the point of the corroboration was in case there was an issue that was not preserved to have an ends of justice exception or something like that. But I don't think the case hinges on that issue now because there were no objections to wife of issues not being preserved other than the motion to strike, which we've addressed.
Doesn't it ultimately go to our jurisdiction? If they're not divorced, do we have anything to decide?
Well, you would first have to vacate, right? If they're not divorced, you would have to vacate the whole order and it would have to be done over again,
counsel,
which is not what...
Let's go back to the beginning. What are the facts essential to obtaining a fault divorce? In other words, what is your client, what is the appellant or appellee required to prove to obtain a no-fault divorce?
That the parties have been living separate and apart, permanently, continuously, uninterrupted for more than a year.
Right, with the intent.
With the intent to remain separate and apart.
Okay, and can you point me to any place in the appendix, any of the testimony or any affidavit that was filed, certainly the General Assembly has provided, that we may now file or you may now file by affidavit or by deposition or by Lori Tennis' testimony before the court, evidence of that? Point me in the appendix, or can you, to any place whereby that corroboration exists?
Of the intent, no, ma'am. I can't point to any place.
Do you have any cases that establish that a divorce could be granted without the corroboration?
No, there are cases that say that it has to be slight corroboration, but I don't know how you would get the intent from the documents. They have separate tax returns. People do file separate tax returns sometimes, even when they're married, living separate apart. Again, there was no allegation that these parties were colluding and weren't really separated.
Okay, so if in fact there are no sufficient grounds for divorce based on the grounds of living separate and apart, then the court has no jurisdiction to go through and to award any type of equitable distribution. Would you agree with that?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the other issue that counsel raised, and just briefly about the motion to strike, was that husband didn't renew his motion to strike regarding the business, that he just renewed his motion to strike.
But you made all those points in your motion to reconsider, which the court then heard. So once the court rules on the motion to reconsider or addresses it, then it's preserved. It's preserved for purposes of appellate review.
The court never ruled on the motion. On the motion to strike or the motion to reconsider?
Okay, reconsider.
Reconsider.
So in other words, it doesn't matter what vehicle, whether a motion to strike, reconsider, or something else, as long as you present it up to the court and the court addresses it, well, then the court has ruled and then you can take it up.
Right. But my client would still have to preserve the issue, would still have to renew the motion to strike on both issues. And I think if you read the whole paragraph, counsel for wife just cited one sentence where trial counsel says, I'd like to renew my motion to strike on the house. But then if you read everything in totality, she then says that wife hasn't presented hasn't met her burden on both issues, and she was talking about the house and the
so
business.
So contextually, that would mean the business.
That she was talking about both. So the two biggest assets involved were the business and the house. The testimony was that Mr. Bell started the business before the parties married, well before the parties married in 1998. It was a car repossession business at that time. In 2002, the same business started selling cars. That, again, was before the parties married. The business was incorporated in 2005, which was after the parties married. However, the testimony was it was the same business. It was still doing car sales. It was still a car repossession business.
It was in the same line of business, but legally it's not the same business.
Right. It could be considered basically a renaming of the business. It's the same business, same assets, same location,
name. It's a different legal entity, so doesn't that put you in a tracing position as opposed to it's the same business?
No, Your Honor, because property acquired from separate property is still separate property, and you don't, without having to, it's not transmuted to marital because you put it into another vehicle. It's just property acquired from separate property is still separate.
We'll assume that I think that the creation of the corporate entity created a new entity, that it is a new business. Mm-hmm. How was it capitalized? Was it capitalized? And to me, that's a tracing question. Was it capitalized with marital assets or not?
And just so you know, you're starting to get into your rebuttal, and you're free to use that time as you see fit.
Okay. I'll finish this one question, Your Honor. Because husband testified, it was all the same. There was no evidence whatsoever that any marital money was put into the business, that the business earned any income that was still left to be distributed, or that the business increased in value at all. It was just he operated the same business, same location, same name, and incorporated it. And so it would just be property acquired from separate property, never transmuted to marital. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Norman Thomas, and I represent Myra Bell, who is the appellant in this case. I want to return to that last point that Judge Russell was questioning counsel about, and that is the business entity itself. Although it is an unpublished decision of this Court, both parties cited it, the Showalter versus Showalter case. And in that case, the husband had some real estate that he owned with his siblings, and it was part of farm property. At some point in time, after the marriage had occurred, they incorporated the farm, and they contributed all property to the farm, to the corporation. And what the Court of Appeals said, in a very gentle but very instructive paragraph, in the Showalter decision is that what the point the husband was missing was that when the incorporation took place during the marriage, it was an asset acquired during the marriage, and therefore it became marital property.
And legally, it's a brand new entity.
Brand new entity.
Now, that puts you in tracing land.
That's correct. And the court, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, so it's a different analysis.
Absolutely different analysis. And rule one of that analysis, the very first place you go, is what is the value of the asset at the time it was transmuted to marital property? What was the value of this business? And there's no evidence in this record. Husband did not come forward in this record with any valuation whatsoever at the time of the incorporation.
Is there any evidence in the record at all, though, that any marital asset was used to capitalize the new entity?
Well, we don't know that exactly. Husband never specifically testified that he rolled over everything from the proprietorship into this corporation. There is an inference of that. I would note at this point that a repo business can be done with a cell phone and a tow truck. But
a car sales business presumably had some inventory at the time of the rollover.
It does. And husband testified that he started selling cars in 2004. That was the year of the marriage. And that it was incorporated in 2005. And that's on page 179 of the appendix.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, but we don't know the value of it. We do know that there was an expansion of business operations around the time of the incorporation. Car sales began. And also, husband is stuck in this case with the trial court's determinations that wife was contributing to this business all along at the time of the marriage and thereafter. She was working for the business. She was working for it there. She was working for it at home. She also was contributing by being a full-time homemaker at some point after the party's child was born, by freeing up the husband's time to do that which is required for an expanding business. And so there is contribution by the wife from even before the time of the rollover through that time and thereafter. And husband can't escape that.
As to this threshold question of corroboration, I couldn't find any cases that specifically address either way, whether you need, you know, a witness by affidavit or otherwise to corroborate the party's testimony. And what you point to is, well, there's no evidence of collusion. Corroboration only needs to be slight. We have documentary evidence that shows they lived at separate residences. But I couldn't find a case that says thumbs up or down, that's enough. So why should that be enough if we can't extrapolate just from the fact that they lived at separate addresses what the intent was? It may have been a temporary separation with the intent to get back together. Maybe they did at some point get back together. I mean, normally when you have a witness, that just kind of ices the cake and you're done. Here, it's a little different, and so I just want to make sure we tread carefully when there's an absence of precedent either way.
Yes, Your Honor. And to go back to a question that Judge Chapin asked, this record does contain documentary evidence. There are arrest warrants, there's protective orders, there's bills that were going to separate addresses, and in addition, there's also testimony from wife that she left the marital home in January 2010 under abusive conditions. There was evidence that she testified to that they continued to have sexual intercourse together for a period of time but did not get back together. And she also testified to something that she did not work out in that way. She testified when she was being very intensely cross-examined about dismissing criminal charges against the husband, and apparently in a domestic abuse situation, that she dropped the charges because he told her that was necessary for them to get back together. But they didn't get back together. And I would submit that... I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, I agree that all those things are contained in the testimony, but ultimately those are not corroboration by the definition. Just their wife nor the husband, based upon the law as the status of the law as it is now, cannot testify that they intended to live separate and apart without any intent to resume marital relationship for over a period of time and get a divorce if it stands here. There has to be, based upon all of the law that I've seen, there has to be some independent testimony, whether it be by affidavit, whether it be by deposition, and you talk about the corroboration, but even your argument on the corroboration is contained in the affidavit, but none of that testimony is coming from husband and wife, no independent witness. Now, I agree that you had that there was an accountant, I believe, that testified, but there was no testimony as to intent or the parties, just their address and their financials. So please help me get to that threshold. We've got a lot of evidence taken, but that's the threshold issue, and if we don't get past that threshold issue, then everything else is moot. You would agree?
Understood. Yes, Your Honor. Judge McCullough is correct that there is no case decided that anyone can find that says it must be testimony. And, Your Honor, we would submit that that is good evidence that it doesn't have to be testimonial. This question has arisen over many, many years of what that slight corroboration when there's no evidence of collusion between the parties can be sufficient. Our position is that it does not have to be testimonial evidence, that there's no case law that specifically states that, and that the inferential direction of that documentation evidence that is in the record would clearly support an inference that they did not intend to get back together, that this was a permanent separation. And yet, if the court's ultimate decision is that it must be testimonial, it must be from a human being, either by affidavit or by testimony in court or a tenant, it's not there. So it really boils down, Your Honor, to whether this court is going to create that construct for the first time in Virginia, or whether slight corroboration through the inferences that can be drawn from other evidence instead of an actual live person by affidavit or in-person testimony, which is the direction that the court will take?
Well, obviously divorce is statutory, which means that the General Assembly has obviously passed certain laws in reference to that. And the last thing that I recall was that it could be granted by affidavit. So have they expanded in any way that you can point to, any way, since it's a statutory animal? You're asking us to basically legislate, almost. You're asking us to certainly expand what the General Assembly has already stated as far as divorce law. So is there anything you can point to that can give us guidance to move forward in that direction?
Your Honor, the thing that we would point to is the combined weight of the precedent over many years that has never said it must be testimonial evidence of one form or another. There are discussions in the cases that go back into the 1940s and 50s discussing only slight corroboration. I remember Chief Justice Eggleston was one of the authors of those Keystone opinions.
So we've read many of those. We have. Yes. I assure you, this panel has been exhaustive search and read all of those cases.
Yes, ma'am.
Should we infer an intent by the General Assembly that they do want a human being at some level to provide that testimony when they amend the statute to allow affidavits? Because if documentary evidence is sufficient, then that's a quicker way of doing it, perhaps, than having a human being prepare an affidavit.
Ms. Bell would not advocate that the General Assembly has limited it, because that in and of itself is an interpretive inference from the legislation that's been passed on the subject. The General Assembly has had many, many opportunities understanding the precedent that the Supreme Court and this court have promulgated over the years to say this corroboration issue, this slight corroboration issue, has to be dealt with through a testimony or an affidavit of a human being.
And we would have to conclude, because there are several moving parts that have to be corroborated, that the fact that you live at separate addresses only corroborates the fact that you're not under the same roof. But it wouldn't necessarily speak to an intent to remain separate. So the corroboration would be sufficient if it's partial, right?
It, to an extent, and yet every case is decided on its facts, and here there are facts that go far beyond merely separate addresses.
So the totality of the facts.
There's criminal charges, there's explanatory testimony about the criminal charges, there's individual tax returns that were filed by him.
But you agree that the mere fact that they're in the divorce proceeding can't provide the inference, because then that would be present in every case?
Correct. Not all by itself, but the entirety of the factual record and that which was offered here, which is far more than just the fact that she lived in Henrico County and he lived in the city of Richmond. There is an enrichment of that single fact by a great deal of other evidence. I did want to speak briefly to this motion to strike. The motion to strike was not renewed on any subject other than the marital home.
Does that matter if we have a motion to reconsider raising a whole bunch of things that the court then rules on?
Of course, the vehicle that's described in the decision that I cited on this issue, the United Leasing Corporation decision, says that it's got to be a motion to set aside. Not a motion to reconsider, but a motion to set aside. That's the first point I want to make. And the motion to set aside was limited to the corroboration issue and the dispensing with signatures issue. But then to the extent that the court ruled on the motion to reconsider, The court looked at the merits of the case and ruled against husband. Yes, and that's final. The issue is preserved for appeal, but not as to a motion to strike. It's preserved on the merits. And we have spent a great deal of time in these briefs reviewing those merits. I want to conclude this way. My time is almost up, Your Honors. There's only one error that the trial court made in this case, and that was failure to back out the value of the mortgage from the marital home. She talked about it in the spousal support award. She clearly was aware of it, and it was just an error of omission on the trial court's part not to back out that amount. That is the only error that Mrs. Bell concedes in this case. And she asks that this court not remand the case on that, but instead back out the amounts, because the valuation of the house on the valuation date of the hearing is a known entity, and the value or the extent of the mortgage is a known entity. And the math can be done at this level and the house ordered sold. And she would ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment in every respect, save that one.
Thank you very much for your argument. Ms. Poss, you have a little over 4 minutes of rebuttal time.
Judge, regarding the mortgage, I don't think it's possible to just, on appeal, back out the mortgage and then say wife gets half of that equity. Our argument was that the home was entirely husband's separate property. Even if the court doesn't find that that's so, I think the evidence definitely proves that at least some part of it was his separate property. He was able to prove when he purchased the house what the mortgage was then, what the mortgage was when they got married, what the mortgage was when it was retitled. The purchase date, actually the marriage date and the retitling date are only about a year apart. He was able to prove the value of the house 2 years before the retitling. There's no evidence that it changed in value at all. So he would be able to prove that at least some part, if not all, of the house was his separate property. The mortgage continued to be paid after they've separated, and has continued to be paid since the parties have been divorced. So there's going to have to be some look at what the mortgage balance is now, because any reduction in principal after he separated on his separate property is his separate property, pursuant to the Wilmoth Tucker v. Tucker case. Even if not entirely his separate, it's part his, and that's increased in value. So it would have to be remanded to take evidence on what the value of the mortgage is now. And also, as far as the business, counsel cited the Shoewalter case. If you look at that case, there was an incorporation, but it was funded with multiple series of hybrid property. So there was evidence that the property used to fund the new asset was actually hybrid at the time, whereas that's not the case with this matter. There was no evidence, there was no allegation, wife never said, when this business was incorporated, it was already hybrid. You know, it had already increased in value during the marriage, or it had already produced some sort of income that was marital property. That was not so. This case is more akin to the Harris case, which we cited in our brief, which involved a series of transactions regarding a house. And in that case, this court actually reversed the trial court's finding that the husband had failed to prove that the current home was his separate property, because there was no evidence at the time that the new joint asset was acquired, that any of the property had increased in value pursuant to marital efforts or significant increase in value due to any personal efforts of the parties. Even if, and even though we don't agree with this, even if the court were to find that the business was marital property, it still has to be valued in order to be distributed. And it was wife who was asking that the business be distributed. She produced absolutely no evidence of its value. Husband testified he was never asked what he, as an owner, as a stockholder, what he thought the business was worth. Wife never said, even if it had been admissible, what she thought the business was worth. The only other person to testify was an accountant who, through her, the tax returns were introduced, but she specifically stated that she was not qualified to testify what the business was worth. So she in no way stated that the tax returns that were introduced in any way stated the worth of the business.
Wouldn't the tax returns be at least some evidence of value? I mean, a profit and loss stream for a business entity would seem to be kind of where you would go for that.
And Judge, if you did go that route, it's nowhere near what the judge valued the business. The judge used the gross income on the tax return to value the business, not the actual net income. So you have a car sales business that at the end of the day makes, I think, is around $30,000 or $40,000 at the end of the year, but she valued the gross income. So she didn't take out the cost of the cars. You know what I mean? Like, you're selling cars, but she included everything. And I think, just as wife conceded on the house, that you have to consider the debts of the house, you have to consider the debts of the business in valuing it. And so you would have to look at just the net income shown on the tax return. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel.